Welcome to the Against the Stream Nashville podcast. In keeping with the Buddha's encouragement to ensure that these teachings are freely offered to all, we do not have any set dues or fees associated with any of our classes or media. In an effort to sustain our ability to do so, we ask that you contribute via our website at againstthestreamnashville.com by clicking the Donate tab, or via the mobile app Venmo by sending a donation to the username at ATS Nashville. Enjoy. Tonight I want to start a series of talks I'm going to give on this topic of the five hindrances. And I'm going to talk on this theme tonight, and I'm actually teaching on Wednesday night this week and the next couple Sundays. I'm going to give about four different talks. And the five hindrances are really, they're qualities of mind or attitudes of the mind that we frequently experience. And that often obstruct clarity and often cause a lot of destruction in our lives. And so it's a really valuable set of themes to look into. Mindfulness, so much of mindfulness is about what we call introspective awareness, which is looking into the mind to see, you know, our mental state and the quality or the attitude of our mind. And these five hindrances, I'll go ahead and name them now. Maybe you'll find that these are familiar. It's craving, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and doubt. Those are the five. Craving, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and doubt. And the interesting thing about exploring the mind from a Buddhist perspective is really in Buddhist psychology, there's not such thing as a good or a bad quality of mind. You know, that what we're really trying to do is look at the attitude of mind, especially like the five hindrances, not something that is getting in the way of our practice, but really something that's becoming our practice. The Buddha is really encouraging us through mindfulness and through these practices and the instructions that he offers to look at the ways that we oftentimes find ourselves in disturbance or distress or amidst challenging mind states, and how we can learn to cooperate and to have a more skillful relationship to those mental states. And so things like craving, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and doubt, these are common mental states that we experience. And so the core function of mindfulness, like I said, is this introspective awareness, which is just noticing the presence and absence of different mind states. Looking into the mind and seeing that your mental state is really what's coloring your whole experience. Like if you wake up and you're in a bad mood, right? And we know what it's like to be in a bad mood. That's introspective awareness. We have that ability. You know, but mindfulness helps us to take more responsibility for the lens that's coloring our perception, how we're seeing things. So the thing that we're looking at with a hindrance is not that it's a bad mental state or that we necessarily need to get rid of it, but it's really something that often obstructs clarity of mind and that leads to a lot of destructiveness. So when we can own it and take responsibility for it, not to identify with it, but to just take responsibility for the mental state, we can start to find a more skillful or more constructive way to work with it. And mindfulness is the balancing of these, the deepening of interest and of cooperation, or seeing clearly and responding wisely. Tonight I want to talk about three big ticket items. I want to actually start not with craving, which is the first hindrance, but I want to start with aversion and talk about aversion, anger, and resentment. If I was going to name the talk tonight, I'd call it drinking the Kool-Aid, not the Haterade. You know, how do we use spiritual practices to overcome aversion, anger, and resentment? You know, what did the Buddha have to say about overcoming aversion, anger, and resentment? And, you know, how do really the basis of these ethical practices of non-harming and mindfulness help us to better manage are aversion, anger, and resentment. And so the reason why I want to start with aversion instead of craving, again, the list is craving, aversion, restlessness, lethargy, and doubt. I like to start with aversion because really aversion is the core or the basis of all of the hindrances. You know, aversion is really kind of a lack of tolerance, or it's this, you know, feeling of dissatisfaction that the Buddha was really keying in on. That so much of our suffering comes from this biological drive for comfort. And we'll talk about this here in a little bit, of managing and trying to find an experience that isn't unsatisfying. And so when we're craving, the basis of craving is really dissatisfaction. It's really aversion. When I'm reaching for, holding on to something, this kind of insatiable thirst or this gripping onto experience, craving, if you've ever wanted something really bad or experienced craving, it's very unpleasant. It's a very irritable and aversive state. The thing about craving that's so interesting is that when you're craving, you're wanting something. You know, and until we get that something, we feel that sense of lack. And so it's the basis of craving, aversion is, and it's also the basis of one of these other hindrances, restlessness, obviously. You know, restlessness and worry, there's the irritability of ruminating thoughts and busyness and obsessive thinking. It's the basis of lethargy, that feeling of being unmotivated or just kind of grumpy, leaning onto our experience or lacking motivation. Like, I have a lot of aversion when I'm sleepy. Especially if I got a bunch of shit to do. I don't feel like I want to do this stuff, and I feel disconnected, or I feel weighted down, or I feel unmotivated. Lethargy can also be, like our sleepiness can oftentimes also be an avoidance strategy. It accompanies depression a lot of times, is that we have a hard time confronting life, and so there's this kind of aversiveness that comes into our lethargy. And aversion is also the basis of doubt. This obsessive evaluating of ourselves and the path that we're on. Am I on the right path? Am I equipped for the path? There's something either wrong with me or the path that I'm on. I've got to change me or I've got to change the path I'm on. We're always kind of, this is a really big hindrance, doubt. The Buddha said it's probably the most destructive of all of the hindrances, doubt. And so I start with aversion because it's the basis of so much of our dissatisfaction or our suffering. And what we're using mindfulness to do is to look into the mind to see the causes and conditions that create suffering. And so much of our suffering is based in our attitude about experience. So much of our suffering is based in how we relate to our conditions of our life, not the conditions themselves. Because we always find ourselves in conditions that we would rather be different or that we would like to have other conditions. We always find ourselves amidst conditions in our life. And it's really how we relate to those or how we are able to learn to develop some acceptance or some ability to cooperate or relate to the conditions of our life in a skillful way, that's where our happiness lies and our relationship to what's happening, not the experiences themselves. And so it's important to look at aversion as a basis for much of our destructive mental habits and behaviors. It's the theme of human stress, like I'm saying. It's, you know, in craving, it's wanting something that I'm wanting something that's not happening right now. In aversion, it's not wanting something that is happening right now. So these are all the hindrances. I'm just going through all five. Craving, I want something that's not happening. Aversion, I want to get rid of something that is happening. Lethargy, I'm wanting to check out of something or I'm unmotivated or not present with something that is happening. Restlessness, I'm wanting to make something stable that it doesn't feel stable. Doubt, I'm wanting to figure something out that I don't know. So there's this wanting, there's this aversion that's really at the basis of our destructive mental habits and behaviors. And what I want to do tonight is I want to talk about this aversion, anger, resentment, and how we can work skillfully with these mental states. You know, how meditation, mindfulness can help us to dismantle the destructiveness of these states, and how we can find more constructive ways to really manage healthy boundaries and to initiate healthy confrontation so anger and resentment doesn't get out of hand, you know, with healthy boundaries and healthy confrontation. So the general theme, I won't talk too much more about it, but the general theme of anger and resentment is aversion at its base. And really this stems from this biological drive that our brain has to seek comfort. The human brain it rewards comfort. That's what it does. The limbic system, your emotional brain, it really has kind of these two goals. Find connection and comfort, which equals stability, which equals safety to the brain, and get rid of threat and get rid of discomfort. And our rational brain, the brain that thinks a lot, is always trying to manage the drives of our lower brains. That's what they say in neuroscience. We have a rationalizing brain that's mostly just trying to get pleasure and avoid pain. And so, you know, it's not that comfort is good or bad. It's good to feel comfort. The problem, and this is kind of the equation of the Buddha's Dharma, is that life is not very comfortable. And so when we live in a brain that's constantly trying to strategize to find it and to secure comfort amidst an existence that doesn't sign us up for that, we come into this big disconnect. And so much of our our dysfunction comes from unconscious attempts to manage our comfort. Much of the problems I get myself into in my daily life come from just attempts to manage discomfort. You know, we develop unconscious habits, addiction strategies, really. You know, if I'm too tired, I'll go drink coffee. You know, if I'm bored, I'll go smoke a cigarette. If I'm lonely, I'll go drink a beer. You know, we get addicted to recognition and status and praise to cope with insecurity. And you know, we get addicted to work and money and, you know, all of this is to cope with insecurity. We get addicted to our physical bodies and what they look like and our attractiveness. And, you know, I have a good hair day, I have a bad hair day. I always have the same hair day. But, you know, we get kind of caught up in this neurotic self-evaluating. And so these are the dysfunction that comes from trying to manage comfort. Because I'm comfortable when I have enough money, I'm comfortable when I have enough pleasure, when I have enough status, when I have enough recognition, when I have attractiveness. And so we got to really look at and learn to work with discomfort. It's one of the primary foundational practices of mindfulness. Is one of the things that we're looking to do is to develop some distress tolerance. Is learning how to recognize that being human is uncomfortable and to not argue with that reality. To sit in some discomfort. And no one wants to do that. You know, I always tell the adolescents I work with that I have the worst job in the world. It's the easiest job because I'm really just doing nothing all day. But it's the hardest job because I'm just asking people to sit with themselves. And if we look at this, this is actually, I think, a lot more prevalent than we realize, is the degree of what it means to sit by ourselves. And that we've kind of come to, even in our culture, the worst punishment that you can get is solitary confinement, being put by yourself. Right? You know, because when we sit with ourselves, we sit with the shocks of our recent past and our remembered past. We sit with the neurotic mind and our attempts to control, and we sit with, you know, all of the fears all the disappointments. We sit with the physical discomfort and the itches and the pain body. And so Hamlet says, we sit with the thousand natural shocks that the flesh is heir to. I like that. The thousand natural shocks that the flesh is heir to. That, you know, being human means we age. It means that we experience this discomfort. And so to tolerate this means that we, with mindfulness, start to sit amidst discomfort and bring cooperation and empathy and understanding to our pain. And learn to strengthen our attitude of acceptance, cooperation, compassion. That's a mental capacity of mind. They even study this in psychology. Daniel Siegel talks about the window of tolerance. This is the strengthening of our capacity to hold our discomfort instead of unconsciously always moving to react to it, to impulsively. That's the second part we're trying to look at, is dismantling what we call the second arrow, which is all the ways that we try to manage our pain. The first arrow is our discomfort. And then we go and create all this other discomfort trying to manage the discomfort. You know, and usually these are short-term, quick fixes. But they keep us in destructive cycles. You know, behaviors that we feel good now in, but that we pay for later. So mindfulness helps us with distress tolerance, and it helps us to start to unhook from these second arrows, these destructive cycles of running around trying to manage the pain of being human. We learn to identify this inner hustler, this kind of person inside that's quick and impulsive. You know, it calls us to comfort. You know, mindfulness has this moment of pause that like has that opportunity to just kind of sit with the sadness or the loneliness or the fear before I jump on my phone and I text my ex, or I go to Kroger and I go, you know, I don't know, buy the cigarettes or whatever I'm going to go use in that moment. Right? There's an endless, the world supplies an endless list of things that can satisfy us right now. So aversion is a big ticket item. It's a good thing that we have mindfulness to be able to develop distress tolerance and to look into our destructive habits and to bring some compassionate reflection, not to judge ourself, to create more shame on top of the already pain that we're experiencing. But just this not arguing with reality. So anger, talking about anger, it's an expression of aversion. Now go ahead and get this off the table, because I think one of the things about anger that we need to work with is this understanding that anger is not bad, but it's often not constructive. So that's the kind of paradox here, is that from a Buddhist perspective, there's no such thing as bad emotion. And from an emotional intelligence perspective, people like Paul Ekman that research emotions, there are what he calls enjoyable and unenjoyable emotions. So it's not good or bad, but there are emotions that we enjoy and there are emotions that we don't enjoy. And anger, we both enjoy and don't enjoy. So it's a very confusing emotion. And it's not a bad emotion, but it's often not constructive. Anger can oftentimes end up in explosive confrontation. It can oftentimes end up in vengeance seeking, in self-righteousness, which is argumentativeness, needing to be right, that type of anger. Passive aggression, which can take the form of punishment, you know, or gossip, divisiveness. There's a lot of forms of passive aggression. Anger has a biological and organic intelligence to it. As an emotion, they call it the remover of obstacles. That's its evolutionary purpose. So it's intelligent. It's a good thing to listen to when we're angry, because it's an indicator that there's some type of threat, or there's some type of perceived threat, keyword perceived threat, that there's some feeling that we're not getting a need met, or there's some powerlessness or fear or sadness that is present. It's a built-in drive to remove threat. You know, the problem with anger is that it's a hot emotion. It's a hot emotion and it's based in fear. Those are two really bad ingredients. A fear-based emotion that's hot, that's like a disaster waiting to happen. Because fear is one of our most primal emotions. So when we feel fear, fear is about safety. So it's like, okay, I don't feel secure, I feel powerless, I'm not in control, I feel fear. That's a big deal for the nervous system. I want to feel more safe and more secure and more certain. And then anger has this kind of sense of being pushed into a corner. So there's that powerlessness aspect to it. Anger can also be turned inward, which we'll talk about in a little bit, and it can have this expression of sadness or depression. So the problem with having this energetic quality of anger, this hot emotion, is that anger gets acted out a lot. Because it's energetic, it's like there's a move to meet a threat, there's a move to solve a problem or to get rid of it. And so it's explosive. So what we do about it, this is how we approach this, is we want to deepen our awareness through mindfulness so we have both more accountability to our emotions and more responsibility for our emotions. More accountability, meaning to know that that emotion is present and to own it. It's here. It's mine. It's in my mind. It's happening in here. We're always, with anger especially, we're looking at the cause. So that's the difference between getting caught up in the content of the emotion and noticing that the emotion is present. So to take responsibility, to be accountable to the emotion, to be responsible, meaning how do I respond with this? What's a healthy way to discharge the emotion, or a healthy way to express this emotion? So we are looking deeply into how we express frustration and irritability, not trying to close off or shut down the emotional state. That's the hard balance. Ultimately, with emotional intelligence, there are kind of four stages of what we're trying to do to help us to have more emotional balance. We need to identify an emotion, access the emotion. You have to be able to feel it. We've got to start to learn our emotions, to understand them. And then to manage the emotion. Those are the four steps. To identify, oh, I'm angry right now. That's what that is. I'm angry right now. And to access, to feel that anger, to have an ability to hold anger. Right? You know that feeling that anger has to it? It's this like kind of powerless, almost like gasping for air. This burning feeling of anger. To be able to access that and to hold that. To have some tolerance for that feeling, and then to understand that underneath the anger is usually some sadness or fear. And to understand that so we can manage it better, so we can actually start to take a moment to pause, and we'll talk about some of the things we can do, to pause and to find out what our need is and to find a healthy way to work through it. So that is really the first step with how do we approach, or how do we work with anger in our daily lives? I think the most important thing to know about it for me is that when we're angry, we often don't have any opportunity to respond constructively. So we need to first be able to pause, to have that moment to cool down enough to skillfully manage the anger. And then we also need to learn, or to have some honesty about our emotional history. You know, if we haven't had much experience with anger in our life, or we've had an unusually high amount of anger directed to us, we'll often have a lot of challenges in identifying, accessing, understanding, and managing the emotion. You know, so if we've had experiences in our life where we were met with anger a lot, or it wasn't around, we oftentimes have we have a learning curve, right? And so we often, a lot of us, because anger is culturally looked down upon or repressed, have a hard time with either overexpressing or underexpressing it. So for me, I'll give an example of my history with anger. My mom admittedly had a lot of anger and rage when I was growing up. It's part of her family history. It's from her father, her mother. There's this kind of dynamic of when I was overwhelmed as a little kid and growing up, oftentimes if I was overwhelmed, I'd go to my mom and the reaction I would get would be I would be met with anger. And so what I learned is that I needed to stop sharing my emotions with my mom. Because when I shared my emotions with my mom, I'd get shut down. So I learned that whatever I was feeling and experiencing was too much of a burden, or it was meant that I would get met with aggression. So I learned to shut down. And then what happened is I started becoming angry or displacing that anger to other people when I was a kid. I became a very angry kid. And when I felt out of control, instead of being able to express the emotion, because I learned to not do that, I would express anger. It was the emotion that I knew how to express. And so I did that for a long time. And then I got into recovery when I was 18. And it was no longer okay to get blackout drunk and high and be an angry mess and be act violently. And so I learned to... Or I think, I don't even know if I learned, I just did. I turned this anger inward. It had nowhere to go. And so I felt like, again, I was left with this feeling of my emotions are bad and I have no one else to express anger towards, so I was angry with myself. Shame and guilt. There's something wrong with me, this kind of feeling that turned into depression. And so... when I got into Dharma practice 7 years ago, I actually started getting a lot of access to anger all of a sudden. And it was very conflicting because I was all of a sudden in this spiritual practice, but I was fucking pissed all of the time. And I was like experiencing a lot of like just anger in my system and I didn't know what to do with it. So I started going to therapy. And for a year and a half or 2 years of therapy, I would go and my experience was just kept coming back to all of this anger. And I had to learn how to express this emotion without shutting it down, without turning it inward, and without turning it outward. And that's where it became really tricky. And I'm still learning how to not shut it down, how to not turn it inward, and how to not overexpress it. And I remember I called my, when I got into this unbalanced phase where I started just kind of handling a lot of confrontation. It was like for all of the time in my life that I had never handled confrontation, I just was like making up for it. I'm like, I'm going to confront everyone that pisses me off. I remember I called my social work supervisor a couple years ago and I was like, hey, Lizzie, I was like, you know, confrontation's a healthy emotion. We're so scared of confrontation. She's like, yeah, it totally is. And she said that, you know, anger is a healthy emotion. We just need to learn that we don't need to use it as often as we think we do. You know, and she was like, reminded me that I was overexpressing this emotion. That anger is a healthy emotion, but if we actually think about it, I think if we do some reflecting, it's not something that even really on a daily basis I need to express. True anger. And so learning our history, I think, is just validating. It's like, oh, okay, it makes sense that this is going to take some time to learn how to work with this. And learning to forgive is another thing through this practice. That like we may notice that. Have you ever acted out of anger and you instantly feel regret after you acted out? Usually, especially when it's towards people that I love and care about. Because anger is a remover of obstacles. But if I care about people and I want them in my life and I express anger towards them, there's this like regret that comes in and almost kind of saves me. It gives me this feeling of, I don't value that. I want to be close to these people. And then I have an opportunity to forgive and an opportunity to resolve that. And there are times where anger is a healthy mechanism to push out people that we don't want to be close with, right? Like, this is also the purpose of it. But learning to forgive, they call, as an emotion, anger a honey-tipped dart, because it has a sweetness to it. There's something that's like exhilarating about confrontation or, you know, expressing this emotion. I had a friend that the other day went to a grocery store and saw a guy wearing what he believed to be Nazi propaganda. And he texted me and he said, should I confront this guy? And this is my friend who's a white heterosexual male. And I said, hey, if you feel comfortable, like, yeah, go for it, you know. And he texted me back. He was like, that was exhilarating, and, you know, exclamation points. But, like, also the responsibility that I think some of us have, especially I'm just thinking of my role as a social worker, to work for, you know, setting up or removing these obstacles that are systems of oppression. Like, going into the areas, if we are the people that can go into these areas and to remove the obstacles, to have healthy confrontation. Because it's especially with systematic forms of oppression, you know, that these are systems that have been in place for years. And if we're going to disrupt them, we're going to have to be disruptive a little bit. We're going to have to be confrontational. We're going to have to actually, like, speak up in the workplace and say, hey, this isn't cool. Or I think that's sexual harassment. And, like, I think that that's not equal wage, you know. Expressing healthy confrontation, which we'll talk about. But going back to the honey-tipped dart, there's this kind of like sweetness, I think, that anger fuels us. One author wrote about this kind of honey-tipped dart, and she said, make a speech when you're angry and you'll make the best speech that you'll never forget, right? There's this kind of like, oftentimes we ride on our anger, especially with the people we're closest to, and we have that regret so quickly after. I know that it's easy for me to get upset with my family members and my close friends. Another way to work with anger is just looking at our priority in the moment. If we have a conflict, we've got to look at how we prioritize that relationship, or our objective or our self-respect. There's this skill in dialectical behavioral therapy that helps us to look at, you know, communication with others. And is what I'm communicating, am I prioritizing the relationship, or do I have some objective that I'm trying to meet, or am I trying to speak for my self-respect in this moment? I'm just kind of noticing what our priority is, and that our priorities change. Sometimes I'm communicating my self-respect, but I have an objective in mind. Like, I have guest teachers that come here, or we have guest teachers that come here a lot, and I have an objective, which is to get that teacher from some other part of the country to here to do a group. Right? And it's not really about, and at times it has been about my self-respect. Like, oh, you want me to make flyers for you and do all this marketing, and don't you know that I have a family, and I have, you know, all of this other work, and that's when my self-respect starts to get prioritized. So that I found that to be a helpful tool. It's like, what am I trying to accomplish here? It's like, oh no, it's the objective that's important. My self-respect is not really needed, or, you know, it's a part, it's always a part of my priority, but it's not my main priority. Or the relationship. And that's a tricky thing, to look at our priority in confrontation. So, learning to investigate with mindfulness and determine our need. Typically, one of the primary emotions is usually underneath anger. Fear and sadness. Feeling fear and sadness is quite uncomfortable for most of us. So it often comes, we feel this vulnerability or a feeling of lack of control. Anger is a manager emotion that attempts to remove the threat of the fear or to keep us from diving into the well of sadness. And so when we have external anger, we often feel an external threat. We feel misunderstood, or we feel powerless. Internal anger is depression. Anger turned inward, guilt, regret, shame, self-resentment. Mindfulness helps us to really look into the fear and the sadness and to investigate, to first stop, to pause, to take a moment to let the anger to cool down, to allow space for the emotion to settle. And when we're able to do that, we can investigate if there's a fear or there's a sadness present, and is there a healthy way to express a need that would better accommodate that fear or sadness. Because we often do regret shortly after we express the anger. So is there a better way to express the need to better accommodate the fear or the sadness? If we can take care of that primary emotion, that secondary emotion doesn't have to come out as much. I also don't like calling anger a secondary emotion, because for some people, when you've experienced it a lot in your life, it feels primary. Sometimes you're angry and you don't feel any fear or sadness. It's just you're used to that emotion. So the goal of this, learning to investigate with mindfulness and determine your need, we need space to think clearly, to see what's really bothering us, and then to decide what it is that we actually want or need to communicate. Perspective taking. Trying to imagine what the other person may be thinking as well or feeling. That's a really quick way to move into empathy when there's a disconnect. Someone says that, forget the saying, but you know, like anger, why do we shout when we're angry? It's because our hearts are so far away. And we feel so disconnected that we're trying to be heard. And so sometimes just stopping and letting that anger settle and trying to empathize or just perspective take is like, I wonder what they're trying to let me hear. I wonder what they're wanting to be heard. And even trying to guess at it. Do you feel hurt? Do you feel disconnected from me? Do you feel scared? Do you feel... It's like even you see that even doing that like moves us in that direction. We've also got to learn to uphold boundaries. So a healthy expression of anger a lot of times is telling people that we aren't okay with certain behaviors. And the thing that's hard about a boundary is it's very hard because it's two things. One, you have to have a confrontation. So you have to sit down with the person and say, this isn't okay with me. And none of us like to do that. So that sucks about expressing a boundary. And then here's what really sucks is most of the time, they're not going to uphold that boundary right away. You're going to have to then keep it. So that means you're signing up for 3, 4, 5 more times of having that conversation, or doing the hard part, which is upholding the boundary that's often inconvenient, meaning letting that person out of your life, not talking to that person anymore, changing your relationship to that person. So for a lot of us, it's like boundaries are sometimes the starting point of separation and confrontation, and having to uphold that and experience the loss or the change of that relationship. And so when we get into the category of resentment, resentment is about refeeling unresolved emotions from our past towards people, places, or things. So it's really like your emotional memory doesn't have this linear map like your left brain does. Your right brain is non-linear. So I can feel and experience anger. Resentment actually comes from the French word raisonner, which means to refeel. And so we refeel emotion or emotional memories even if the experience isn't happening now. Even if the experience is old. So much of our past visits us in the present, in our brain, in our body, in our mind. And if we think about the resentments that we have in our life, they're often towards, and even if you just take a moment to kind of reflect, like, if I think about, like, whom am I upset with in my life? Who have I been upset with recently? These are mostly people that have been close to me. And so there's a tremendous need to learn how to heal and to work with our resentments, to find ways to resolve past harms caused to us or harms we've caused to others. And to practice forgiveness, giving up any hope for a better past. You know, to practice forgiveness and to understand that forgiveness is not about forgiving the action that was done to us. Some actions, some things in the world that are done are unforgivable. There are such things as bad things to do. There are such things as bad things to do, things that are harmful, harmful actions. To forgive the actor instead of the action. To understand that most harm comes from a place of confusion, sometimes severe confusion, ignorance, pain, suffering. Resentments usually come from two things. They come from experiences and they come from expectations. The big items of resentment are from our experiences. Harm that have been done to us out of abandonment or neglect, betrayal, physical, emotional harm. And so we got to start to look at, you know, even just being interested, how do we heal these big events? How do we learn to let go of resentments while not invalidating the harm that we experience? That's a tricky thing. It's like to both acknowledge that the harm that was caused was real, and that it was felt, and that at the same time, by holding on to that resentment, we're the ones that suffer from it. And resentments come from expectations, like looking at how we oftentimes expect perfection out of ourselves and others. We have expectations that we have self-resentments. We have a lot of expectations, especially on the people close to us. Those are where those resentments come from a lot of times. That, you know, the people that are close to me, I expect them to do better. Why doesn't everyone just act like me? And it's stupid to say out loud, but a lot of my resentments come from that place. Like, why don't you just kind of act like me? I don't do that. You do that. You stop doing that. It's kind of like self-righteousness, entitlement. And you know, so like this is a big part of our practice is to learn how to see the pain and suffering in other beings and to have some humility and just some compassion and forgiveness for people in their process. And I like to look at, can I assist people in their process instead of trying to have, you know, try to make them perfect in their process. These are some thoughts of mine on this category of aversion, anger, resentment. I know it's a lot, and hopefully some of this resonated, and hopefully some of this we can bring into the room. We've got a lot of time for discussion, and so You know, if something resonated for you, I always like to encourage people, you're welcome to share in the room, and there's some guidelines. You can use I, me, my statements. We don't want to give advice to other people, but we don't need to be an expert of anything other than our own experience. So please feel free if you feel like something resonated or you have something to share. That's what this time is for. So open it up.
Thank you.